Yes, I believe it was plot number 8. As I said, it was behind the recreation hut. We used to have to go up to Bill Stretton's up Rowlands Hill Farm. That's up the top of the drift with Deb with his old cart and pick up cow manure and bring loads of that back to the allotments here. And also he used to have two large greenhouses at home where he used to specialise in growing tomatoes. So every third year we reluctantly had to help him dig out about 2.5 feet of the ground, and then he would stack it outside, and then we would put about 1 foot of manure down, and then we would backfill on that, and then we was all right for another couple of years while he was growing his tomatoes. That was quite a source of income back then, because he had just lost his leg and that, and I suppose it was lucky he was on the corporation because they had superannuation, and there was allowed 13 weeks a year, I believe. No questions asked if he was ill. Not that they had to be told, because they knew exactly what it was. After that, they would send a doctor in just to make sure you was, you weren't playing up. But he was a charge end plumber down there, and it was all pretty legit. And that was that. Another thing down the down the Lavants, which comes up, as you know, every so often. Another little source of an earner was to when the Lavants was up, and of course back in the 50s you had cars that really, if you didn't drive them through very slowly, your Austin 7s and things like that, they just petered out, and there they were sat in the middle of the Lavants, stuck. They couldn't get out without getting wet feet, and we would be sat on the wall with wellies and that. And they would start talking to us, and unless they talked money, we really weren't interested. And then it was, they'd offer you a tanner or a shilling to push them out. And of course, then we were in business. So that wasn't a little bad earner. That was where it was. Just up from there, behind the opposite Beechwood, there used to be the Nissen huts and that. And the late 50s and that, middle to late 50s, we used to have the disabled scouts would come down from Allsford, and they would camp in the Nissen huts, and then they would go out on days, like go to Hayland, occasionally we would go with them, to Havant on the Hayland Billy. And go to Hayland, and then you'd have Beechlands and all that type of thing. They were usually there for about a week, and of course we spent a lot of time down there with them. The fates and that, we used to have in the 50s Colonel Farmer, Mrs. Farmer up at Philco, up at Lynx Lane, used to have the annual Conservative fate. And that was, most of the village would turn out for that. You would have at Philcote, yeah, which is almost opposite where I suppose Mrs. Openshaw used to live. Admiral Leighton used to be in where she used to live. And Tower Cottage, or Water Tower Cottage. And with the Water Tower just that little bit further up. People like, I remember, mid-50s, Tommy Trinder, he opened it one year, and he wanted half a crown for his autograph, which we thought was extremely, because he was an oldish bloke to us, and we thought that was a little bit out of order, half a crown. We thought, if we give him a tanner, that was just worth scribbling on a bit of paper, but... people like him used to open it, And of course, you know, they would have the coconut shies and all the various things, you know, the electrical wire thing, you know, that that they used to do. You would have all that type of thing. And when that finished, they moved it down to Mr. Winnicott's down at Dearley. He was established in there. He had just bought the brickyard and that he had, and he opened the gardens out, and again they put on a very good show, you know, a very good show. And much the same thing as up at Mr. Farmer's. Again, that was the Conservatives again, and then towards the end of the 60s, that petered out, because I believe then the brickyard had packed up, and the Reeves had moved in from Emsworth and was using the brickyard for building storage, and of course he obviously moved out, and then you had this about 5 years where they had once had it in the sling, and really it was petering out until the, as I call it, the modern day. A lot of your newcomers were coming in, your Mr. Billums and people like him, and then they, in 73, they started up the village fair, and well, the rest is history on that one, isn't it? Because that's going from strength to strength. on the village green, it's a pity the parish hall was not used a little bit more, because back in the 20s they used to use it at the recreation grounds. You know, Walls would come up with their slides and swings and all that type of thing. They would have their races and that, and talking to Joe Jacobs and that, they would have, you know, they would have half mile races round there, and there was all good prizes and that it was to be had. But that obviously came to an end before the Second World War. You know, I got stuff, you know, granddad's advertising used to advertise in the fake programs and that, got all that type of stuff. And that's where it was held originally. And of course, as I say, 73, they started up the new fake that is held to this day. And that's how that used to go. The other one that we used to be put on was the Patronal Festival up at the new rectory. A lot of people call it the old rectory, but the old rectory is a little bit further up, opposite where Red Hill House used to be. The new rectory, Reverend Force, who took over from Reverend McKay, he had this Patronal Festival, and that was done on a similar type of thing as it was at Farmers and at Winnicott's when they held it in Dearley. It wasn't so grand, but obviously the gardens were smaller, and the school always put something on, St John's School, where we all went to school. You know, all my brothers and sisters went up to St John's School. That's when it was the school on the Red Hill Road, not on the Witcher's Gate, which is the new one. And of course, the new one was our football field. We used to play football down there, or cricket, or whatever the case may be. Through the 50s, we used Mr. Brace, who took over Grandad's Snob and Shop. We used to go up there about 2 p.m. and sit out under his old shop, waiting for him to finish his dinner. And he would take us up there to practice football when we used to play for St. John's Church, and we used to play teams like from St. Faith's that haven't. And you know, that was a sort of Sunday afternoon out the way. We had choir practice, used to do the choir practice in the week. That was an excuse to get out in the dark. As long as you had excuses, Mum never said anything, you know. So we would go extremely early to the choir practice. Just, of course, then we all got together in the old car park up there and amused ourselves and that, and had a laugh between ourselves, and then we'd done the choir practice. Very occasionally we would go up to the Stubbingtons, up at Oaklands, and if there was Christmas was coming on, and if any of us had to sing solos, you know, once in War David City, anything like that, you might go up to the Stubbingtons, and they would just sort of finalise you through there. And of course, with the older boys, Miss Stubbington, they used to have the cigarette cases around and that. And I no need to say any more. The cases never used to go, but pockets would be filled up, and the cigarettes used to grow legs. So we was always keen to go and see Mrs. Stubbington. And also one of the boys used to have a fish pond, and she had a fish pond and that out. And on more than one occasion, I know nets were taken, and they were catching goldfish in a bucket and whipped them back home. I know it's not very churchified, but we just felt that as fair game. We did. A gran, when Grandad died through the 40s, gran was a great British Legion woman. And she used to do a lot of help the Stubbingtons with their entertainment and that. And of course, I think the main thing was not so much helping them with the entertainment; it was leaving Gran to do the washing up and all that sort of thing. I remember that Dad used to mutter about that, you know, that poor old Gran got caught again. But Gran looked at it the other way, that they couldn't. They wouldn't be able to have the function unless she went up there. My cousin Dave used to garden up there also, until in the late, 59, I think they had to sell up. For one reason or other, they had to sell up, and they give the bottom field that we used to play football for St John's, that was given to them, I believe, and of course, which is the new school is built onto now. So that's how that came into. Also at Oaklands, at the end of the spring term, or going into the summer, we used to have the school sports. And the Stubbingtons. Yes, originally it was Colonel Stubbingtons. He was to do with the breweries, he was. I believe that's where he made his money. And he was back in the Hodgkins, when there used to be governesses, at Red Hill School. He used to have a lot to do with the school. So you know, and the four girls, one of them was married, and I think three of them weren't. And they used to do a lot of work around the village. You know, they'd done a lot of work around the village. Like when the Battersea, when during 39, when the Battersea School had to come down this way. Two-thirds of the boys from Battersea, they come down on the train to Petersfield. The girls were billeted in Petersfield, and they went to the high school. And a third of the boys went to Hawkley, which is just out of Petersfield. They stayed in that village, and the other two-thirds. And like if you had a young sister of four or five, she would come with you. You weren't split up. And they were billeted all round Finchdene, and all up through Rowlands. And of course, the Stubbingtons would come round and view your house, and you were told what you were going to have and what going to have, and all that nonsense. You know, back in the days when you doffed your hat, they call it. Having said that, you mentioned Dimmock White, when he used to have the four in hand, he would come through the village occasionally. The same was him. They did like you to, you know, the elderly people, to touch their hat and that, because if you had any functions and that on, they were the first ones you went to, and they always contributed to it. So you had to play ball by them. And of course, as Rowlands Castle is sort of split up into four like estates. You have Dimmock White with South Lee, and you would have had the Fitzwigerans with Lee Park, which was up through Durrance, and their houses, the Fitz Roydron's houses always had the red corrugated tin on the houses, and that came up to Castle Road. There was houses in Castle Road with the red corrugated, so they come under Lee Park. And of course you had Idsworth the other side, and then there was Stansted. And of course, before my time, that is, well, I know we shouldn't go back that far, but if you worked for that, whoever you worked for in that little estate, you had the Tide Cottage and that, so if you fell out with him, you had to move on to the next one. It was hard days then, obviously it was. Anyway, back to the school. We used to have the school sports down on the lower level of the lawn, and they used to set the prizes out on the top, on the, you know, on the first part of the lawn and that. And myself, John Bentham, he was my only competition. We used to do the 60 yards, and I suppose it wasn't big-headedly, but I always used to go and see what I was going to win, and it was always a book or something like that. And we weren't very educated, and we used to look at this book and think, oh, you know, we could afford better things. But anyway, that was educational. I suppose that was the way the prizes went, because you run your race, and I always used to just pip old John. And John used to come to second, and then you got your prize. At the back end of the school day, you would have the parents doing, you know, three-legged race and all that type of thing to involve them in it. And so that was, I can only remember on about one occasion it got rained off, but that was a good day, because you had to take all the stuff up from the school, set it all out, and then you would have to take it all back afterwards. So yes, the Stubbingtons, they were they were pretty good people. They were pretty good people. You couldn't run them down. And also back in the 50s, we had the motorcycle scrambling, which used to take place at Idsworth Farm, the home of Mr. Bert Bussell, and his son is still in the village to this day, up at Walesworth, John, who used to ride. All through the 50s, they had scrambles, about four a year, caused quite chaotic scenes through the village, streets, because they're very narrow up through St. Hubert's and that. And at the end of the 50s, they used to have crowds of about 10,000 used to come up there, so it was quite chock-a-block, because we used to run across used to come down White Hill, cross into Finchdean, whip up across St. Hubert's, and we used to nip through the woods, and of course that saved us paying, so that was mission accomplished. And then you got in on the top of the scramble course, and then you worked yourself down to the straights, and it was very big time. And in those days you had people like Phil Nix, who was a BSA works rider, Jeff Smith was just come along, who became the world champion. The Swedes, Kay Bornybush, they first appeared in those days on the Gold Stars, the BSAs, and because they were used to sand racing, so they were quite entertaining to watch. Motorbike and sidecars was an extremely new thing, and Mr. Sawyer, who lives down at the Finchdean Road now, he used to have a shop at Portsmouth, and he and his boys used to do grass track racing, and Mr. Bussell wanted to start up sidecar racing, so Mr. Sawyer adapted one of his grass track race outfits into what they call motocross today, but into scrambles as they were, because the grass tracks, the machines are extremely close to the ground, which would have been no good for up at Idsworth there. So yeah, he was one of the forerunners on that. He also used to ride the TT with motorbike and sidecar. Not that I see him, but we used to go to the TTs, but that was slightly before my time. But yeah, the scrambles were very popular. And next door to us at 26, we used to have Dave Small, who was another local star, used to ride the mattresses. And I always knew when there was a scramble coming up, because his father used to be a farmer. They used to keep pigs, chickens and that down the garden. They used to keep rats as big as cats down there. They were massive, these rats were. And of course, Dad, his garden was similar to the allotment back up here opposite the parish hall. And just before the scrambles, Dave used to get out in his dad's garden, and he used to start tuning his matchless and that up, and he used to do practicing in his garden. And I've sat up by the shed, Matt, and watched Dad down there, digging the early spuds and that. And there's Smallie going in the garden with the tires spinning and the mud shooting up in the air, and it was showering down on the old man down the garden. And he used to look across him, and I'm sure he could have killed him. I could see that as though it was yesterday. And so we always knew when the scrambles were coming up. A very popular feature that was. Used to have the youth club in the village. St John's had their youth club up at the hill, and Reverend Force, when he had they had their dances, and it was the end of the sort of big band era, and you had waltzes and foxtrots and all that type of thing. Well, us at that age in the 50s, that's the last thing we basically wanted to do, and because rock and roll was in, and Mr. Force wasn't really going to have any of that. But after a while, my elder brother and that, they kept hammering away from him, so they come to an agreement that they would have one or two dances, like waltzes and quick steps, and then you would have a rock and roll a little session. So that's how they came about that. The youth clubs also, mostly the Castle Road boys, it was, they got together and they formed the Skiffle Group. I don't know, like a folky type of music, where they used the washboards with thimbles on your hands. They had spoons. Conduct was on the guitar. Buster McGraw was on the bass. One of the Millers was a rhythm, and my brother was on the washboard, and they done the skiffle. And when they at these functions, they used to practice up at the brickyard, up in the there used to be a garage as you go up the brickyard lane, where it forks off. One you go down to get your building supplies, and the other one is where the lorries go to come round. There was a garage there, and they used to get in there, and they used to practice. And so apart from local stuff, that's basically what they've done. But it was quite, I've got photos of that. You know, I'll put them out down at the fete. That was quite exciting times. So At the top of the green, we had the CAF during the 50s. The Rickards, who used to have it as the tea rooms, which was quite a large place. They used to have functions and that there. Bill Lewis, he came into the village and he run a CAF there. He introduced the jukeboxes. That's when the rock and roll was about, and the Americans were coming in, you know, with their recording stars. So you had the jukebox. You used to just serve teas, and you'd have your donuts or whatever, you know. There wasn't a lot to have, but it was a meeting place. And next door you had Mr. Evans, who was the hairdresser, and I believe his wife done the ladies for a while. And then when Mr. Evans left in the towards the late 50s, Mr. Mogg took over. He was a he was to do with the Navy. He came in, I believe, from Gosport. And of course, Mr. Mogg and Mr. Lewis didn't really get along, and they were always at loggerheads. And Bill used to supply him with tea, and then they would fall out for some unknown reason. And then the tea wouldn't appear, but you used to have your hair cut on a very regular basis in those days. And then on the Sunday, our religion was to meet down there late Sunday morning and into the afternoon, and you know, catch up on the local gospel, you know, amongst the boys. And then we'll get off up the recreation ground, and we'll have anything up to about 20-a-side football, which went on to about 4:30. And yes, that was religion to us. I enjoyed that, you know, every time. And going back further from that, during the summer from school, when we used to finish, we used to get up the rec about 7 o'clock, and from 7 to 9, we used to have a section down where the tennis court is at this time, and we used to play down there all the time. We did. Lee Park was just being built, and of course some of the Lee Park boys used to come up on their motorcycles and that. And another spectacle, or I thought it was, when they come up on their bikes and that, and one or two of the locals too. They used to go up to the top of Castle Road, and they used to have, I suppose, once a month they'd have like a burn up. They would all disappear up the Horndean Road to very close to where Keydale is now, and then it would be the first one past Castle Road. And I thought it was a spectacle, you know, to see six abreast coming down the main drag, and you know, on a Sunday morning, and yeah, that was great fun. And of course, bikes were very much a thing with us as nippers. My sister's first the boyfriend, Collett, down Woodbury Lane, he used to have a tiger cub, and on during the summer he would disappear up. He would leave his bike outside the railway hotel with the key left in it, and he would disappear up Stansted to do whatever one does, I don't know, you know, with the sister and that. And we used to pinch his bike, and we used to go all around the country roads. He used to have a tiger cub, a 198 tiger cub, and we used to thrash it all round Stansted, and come up there by Emsworth, up through the village. And we was only about 14 at the time, but no one seemed to ever take any notice of it. And that's how I sort of bit the bug on bikes. That's right, yeah. When we come to leave school, our first job, we took on a job up at Finchdene Ironworks, or PFI as it was called then. Mr. Phillips had started a business. He took over the Matthews scrapyard. It was a scrapyard and it was had all the old cars and that in there. And how we come to get the job is that me and my mate Bummer Burt, we was up at Finchdene and we see all these old cars and that. So we thought we'll have a nose around. So we went in the yard and had a nose around, and this Mr. Phillips come out and caught us. And he said, asked us what we was doing in no uncertain terms, and we said, we're looking for a job. And he says, come with me. So he took us into the garage, and he gave us brooms, he did, and he said, you sweep up that side and you sweep up that side. So, which is what we'd done. We'd done it for about 20 minutes. And at the end, he got us together and he said, I'll take you on. That was me. And Dave Burt, he did take him on. Anyway, when I went to start work there, and he said, do you know why I took you on? I said, not really. He said, well, he said, you moved everything and swept under it. He said, and the other merchant just swept round it. So I says, oh. So he said, that's basically why I chose you. So I had 2 years down there. I spent a lot of time hacking up cars and that. I was meant to be training to be an agricultural engineer. But after a short while, I could see that I wasn't going to do that. I was basically there to chop up cars and that. And he won a contract to do some iron stillages for the Romans Castle Brickyard. Mr. Winnicott had taken over the brickyard, and he was modernising it. When he took it over, it was all steam. It was steam, and they would never start the mill up. Would never start before say 10 o'clock, because of all the leaks in the pipes. If you walked around the yard, the chap would turn up about 6:30. He'd have his boilers flat out, and wherever you worked, wherever you walked around the brickyard, there was steam flipping and belching out of these broken pipes and that. And it took to about 10 o'clock before the mill got going. So when Mr. Winnicott took over, he obviously could see they were busy going nowhere. So he put in electric motors to drive the main mill and, driven on belts. So we won the contract to make these stillages. Up to that point, they used to load 60 on a barrow, and then you went from the mill to the drying rooms, or what meant to be the hot air drying rooms, but there was usually no heat there as such. And you would stack in a sort of pyramid type style. You could leave them there to dry. And the trouble with the barrows with 60 bricks on, if you you always stood at a jar of the Crowden barrow, and you always had one of the handles sort of between your legs. And if you didn't take the bricks off religiously, three this side, three, 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 if some of them used to take off all one side. And of course, then the Crowden barrow had 30 bricks on one side, and then the handle would come up and catch you, where you didn't want it to catch you, which happened to a Mr. Applin, who lived up at King's Close, and there was quite a about that. Anyway, to alleviate that sort of problem, Mr. Phillips, he was asked to do these iron crates, so you could, of angle iron. And when I was working for him, I used to go down to Harry Pound's yard down at Portsmouth with Len Tupper. He used to give me a lift down there on his motorbike sidecar. And we used to go down there, and there used to be a mountain of these army beds. And he used to pick them out, and I used to use an axe to chop all the springs out just to leave a square iron frame. And then Mr. Phillips would come down in the afternoon with the oxyacetylene, and he would cut the ends off, and then we would load all the straight angle iron onto his lorry, and we went back to Finchdene. Then we would have a session. He had a guillotine cutter, we'd have a session cutting them all to the correct lengths, and then we had to jig them up, and then he used to spot weld them and make up these stillages, and then from there we used to deliver them to the brickyard where a few of my mates used to work. So at the end of the contract, we delivered all the crates and that, and of course they were on a lot more money than what I was, and I felt I was sort of going nowhere in the agricultural business, so I left there, and then I joined the brickyard, and done basically what a lot of them done. There were certain blokes kept on certain jobs. And then there was the people like myself who used to float around filling in for people. You know, that you'd fill in if one of the drawers didn't turn up. And the drawer was where you drew the hot bricks out, and then you sorted them out, put them on certain heaps, and then when the lorries come in and they wanted, say, 3,000 multi-grades, they went to the heap and you had to handball them on, or you might be put on setting or running to the setters. That's taken out the bricks that were meant to be leather hard dried, and then you would take them to the chambers, and they would set them out in certain ways that when the fire come round, the fire would feed all through the holes of the bricks, and you was meant to turn out with a few thousand bricks, but it didn't used to work out that way because there was no drying facilities of such. Mr. Winnicott put in large jet sort of engine heaters, but it never the whole place was a very drafty place. And they never really were efficient. And that's the sort of jobs that you would be set out on, or you would be put down, you might go down to the pit face and do grafting. That's taking all the grass and all that off. So when the digger, he was working on, say, a 30-foot face, he didn't bring a lot of weed and all that in with it, because as that came through the machinery, that used to mess up the machinery. So basically what used to happen was from the pit face you had a quite antiquated digger, all done on wires, not like the JCBs and that you see of today, but it had large cables on it, and it all looked cack-handed as it worked. But anyway, they used to load these skips. I suppose they used to put, I don't know, say 2 ton of clay in the skips, and then you had a very antiquated railway system to take you to the bottom of where the mill was placed, and you'll have some chap waiting for him to be loaded up. He would take it down the railway, and then he would hitch on a winching rope, and then it would be winched up to the ramp, up to the chap who was at the top of the mill, and he would empty the skip into there would be two massive great rollers going around in like a tin tray with all little grills and that in it. And as he chucked the clay into, as it was a very slow worm that picked up the clay and then just chucked it bit by bit into where these two massive great wheels were turning round. And as the clay fed in under the wheels, it was just completely squashed, and it was pushed through these little grill holes to make the clay extremely small. From there, it would have dropped down between two sets of twin rollers, which was meant to roll it, squash it, and it used, the theory was, it was meant to come out wafer thin, but in places you could put your, when the mill was stopped and that, and you was cleaning these rollers out, you could put your hands up in between them, so you used to have, instead of a nice thin stream of clay dropping down into the massive worm that fed the mill, you would have lumps just dropping down into the mill. And what happened then, it dropped down into a receiving bed, which had a very slow worm on it, which picked it up, and then it took it to a die cast piece of machinery exactly the size of a brick, and it had pipework all around it, and it was connected up to diesel oil, which was the lubrication, so you had no sticking in that. And then as the worm fed the clay into this we used to call it the bow wow mouth, as it came into that, you had a column of a brick, the exact size of a brick, you had a column come out on the belt, and that kept going. And then there'd be a chap on the mill, he would be cutting it about 6 foot long at a time, and he would then take it to one side of himself, and there would be a setup with like a shunter that goes to and fro, and then you would have on the slab, you would have wires the size of a brick. So as you put this column of clay in behind the shunter pushed it through the wires, and you ended up with an exact brick. And if there was a lot of flints or vegetation, anything in the clay, the wires and that would snap, or they would scratch. If you look at a castle brick, you on the sides you would have a load of grooves going down them. Some of them you don't have it happen, some of them you do, and that's when the wires used to get extremely grubby. Anyway, once the bricks were cut into a brick size, the boys on the mill table would put them onto the crates and load the crate up. When it was full, it was picked up with a little pneumatic trailer and pumped up, and then it would be taken to the drying rooms. That's what's meant to happen. And then from there, the drawers would, or the runners for the blokes, not the drawers, the setters, the blokes that was running for the setters, they would go up and down all the drying rooms to find out, you know, the bloke setting, he might want leather hard bricks for the bottom, and he would want wet for the top. But quite often, they never had no choice; they were all wet anyway. And hence why, when they used to set, if you set out wet bricks on the bottom, and bearing in mind that the chamber was 12, 13, 14 feet high, that amount of bricks stacked on top of one another, that's why they go banana shaped, especially as the heat comes around. Anyway, once it's set, there's up there we used to have the Hoffman kiln, and it was called a continuous, and it had about 16 chambers, 8 down each side, and it's called a continuous because the fire is continuously going. So what would happen, you would set a kiln about 2-3 in front of you. You'll have the boys drawing them where the fire had been, and then about 4 chambers in front of that, you'd have the actual fire being stoked from above. They used to have potholes going across the width of the chamber, and every 20 minutes they would put about half a shovel full of coal or coal dust, as the case was quite often the case, to keep the fire going, and they would stoke every 20 minutes. And then and if the drafts were okay on each corner of each kiln, up on the continuous, you would have a screw handle where you could open a large plate in the actual kiln to let more draft through to keep the fire going. But if you had too much bad coal in there, that never used to happen. Your other enemy was, because they used to use a lot of wet clay instead of leather hard dry green stuff as it should be, they had a steam problem, because as the fire got close, as the fire sort of caught up the kilns that had been set already to be fired, they started drying out, and of course you've got a lot of moisture, evaporation in that, and the stokers were always having trouble trying to keep the fires going. So that's basically how it would work, and then you would have, I suppose you would have 10 kilns that were basically left open. So that's how it used to operate. And
did they stoke the fires day and night?
Yes, it was continuously going. And it was always said Mr. Winnicott would sit in his front room, and when he would come back or for some do or whatever, and he would sit in the front room, and he could tell by the smoke out the chimney if the stokers were doing their job. He knew that every 20 minutes there should be a puff of smoke coming out there. So they couldn't really get away from that one. It used to go to, I think it was 11 under Fahrenheit, I believe it used to get, they used to burn to. I've got all that at home, I never wrote that down. But that's the heat that they used to go
how
to.
How many people did the brick
It used to be about 30 in my time. It used to have about 30. You had three down the pit. You had the chap up the top putting the clay down through. You had two, four, you had six on the mill. You obviously had the foreman. You had the driver. You had the bloke sanding the bricks, and you had at least say four or five drawing, and the same would be setting. So that's basically how it was worked, lorries would come in, and you would load them up with whatever they wanted to. The quality was not the best, and through the late 60s, I mean, I left there in about 64, and we had been laid off twice up to that point, and I know I went home and I said to Mum that I think this lot's going to come to an end, because I said he keeps laying us off. And then they got an order, and then they would take you on. And I thought, it's about time I got out of that one. So I left there, and then I joined Powell Lillywhites, who were the local builders then at that time. And I worked for them. We'd done Tesco's at Waterlooville and Boots at Waterlooville. I was there with Leo Link. We set all that out, done all the drains and that before the subcontractor brickies and all that came in. The late 80s, that came to an end. Mr. Lillywhite, it was Powell Lillywhites, but the Horry Powell, he had died, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years before, and he was the sort of brains of the outfit, and it was basically going downhill slowly. And anyway, we was made redundant, and when we went back to the yard at the Rowlands Castle Road, where Powell's had their lorries, we went back there to unload all the gear and that, and like you do, you just have a nose around, and I bumped into this bloke who was remoulding tyres. And I just put my nose in there and just stood there for 5 minutes watching. He says, "Oh, are you interested in doing this?" And